You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 5th of April, 2024, on Monocle Radio.
South Africa's election shapes as unusually interesting. The gathering revolt against automation and the great apple juice conspiracy. I'm Andrew Miller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Miller. It's Friday, so it's our weekly in-house daily, and the Monocle staffers who proved to have the least game at Rock, Paper, Scissors were Emma Searle, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Webb. They will discuss the day's big and more medium-sized stories, and we'll hear from the US-Canada border as the region braces for a deluge of tourists looking for the best place to watch the sky turn black. Stay tuned. All that and more coming up right here on the Monocle Daily. This is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Amid 2024's epic global democracy off, with maybe half the world voting in some election or other, South Africa's parliamentary elections next month may not loom as the most obviously riveting contest. Since South Africa embraced universal suffrage 30 years ago, its elections have had a somewhat monotonous quality, which is to say that the African National Congress has won all of them. It may not be quite so straightforward this time, however, and joining me to explain why is Emma Searle, Monocle's executive producer. Emma, first of all, what has happened to the ANC's hitherto robust support?
Well, that is the big question, and President Cyril Ramaphosa has already begun campaigning. And first, perhaps let's hear a clip.
Many people keep spreading this false narrative that the ANC has done nothing. Our people know what the ANC has done. They see what has already been achieved. And they know that South Africa is a better place than it was when we were under apartheid.
A low bar. President Cyril Ramaphosa, what is the case there he is trying to make?
So, I mean, that is the big question. I think it's really interesting because this will be South Africa's seventh general election post-apartheid, that is, of course. And I think it's fair to say that the stakes are higher this time, especially for the ANC. And that's because the ANC, since South Africa became a democracy, has enjoyed an absolute majority for three decades. And we've essentially had a dominant party system. And now that's under threat. And if the polls are to be believed, this election could see the ANC getting less than 50% of the vote. And if that happens, the ANC will be forced to enter into a coalition, which would be a first for South Africa. And that's really significant. And I think, you know, one must remember that post-1994, the ANC was historically untouchable. It commanded this widespread loyalty, in part because the ANC was seen as a beacon of freedom during the anti-apartheid struggle, and everything Nelson Mandela stood for as a freedom fighter has very much been an essential part to the ANC's DNA and ANC as a brand even. But that is wavering, and actually pretty much every poll taken recently has found that support for the party is declining and very fast. The Wits School of Government's poll has support for the ANC at 39%, which is a far cry from the party's best ever result in 2004, which was under President Thabo Mbeki, when it got almost 70% of the vote. And I think the reason for this is that many South Africans, contrary to what President Ramaphosa was saying in that clip that we just heard, they think that life has not improved. And the overriding feeling is that the ANC's reputation has been tarnished by corruption allegations, especially under former President Jacob Zuma, a failure to address crippling poverty, high crime rates, high unemployment, and relentless power cuts, locally referred to as load shedding, which has just been disastrous for business. And so, of course, the ANC will be trying to put the case that they are working hard to fix all of these problems, but the opposition parties say otherwise.
So who are these opposition parties which are hoping to profit from the diminution of the ANC support?
Well, there are many, and I think there are over 200 parties actually running in the election on the 29th of May. But the two dominant ones would be the Economic Freedom Front and the Democratic Alliance. And we have a clip of two leaders of these parties.
On the 29th of May, South Africa will either emerge into a dreadful reality controlled by Julius Malema, or it will embark down a new path empowered by the multi-party charter. A vote for the DA is a vote for a new multi-party charter government with strong partners that have a credible plan to know how to get things done.
We are in darkness now. Our people don't have electricity. Load shedding has killed a lot of businesses. And as a result, because businesses are gone, a lot of our people have lost jobs. Through load shedding, Ramaphosa is continuing to kill our people in South Africa. And that's why we must vote to stop load shedding.
Two fairly different tones of electioneering there from the Democratic Alliance and the Economic Freedom Fighters. Briefly, though, what is their pitch beyond "we're not the ANC"?
Yes, so they're pitching themselves very differently. You're absolutely right. But to put this into context first, I think it's important to say that the DA, the Democratic Alliance, run by John Steenhuisen, who we've heard from first, they're currently polling at around 19%. And the EFF, who the leader of which is Julius Malema, who we heard from second there, they're polling at around 16%. So they are the most popular opposition parties out there, but they're still, you know, a lot lower in terms of support rate compared to the ANC. But the DA is currently in control of the Western Cape, which is one of South Africa's nine provinces. And they're pushing for greater privatization of the economy. They've promised to end the power cuts and create 2 million new jobs. And I think the issue of unemployment is massive in South Africa. It's currently unemployment in South Africa is at a damning 33%, which is the worst in the world, according to the World Bank. And as we heard in the clip, the DA is currently leading the so-called multi-party charter, which is essentially a group of smaller opposition parties have all banded together and they've agreed to form a coalition. If combined, they manage to get over 50% of parliamentary seats. So that's their pitch. Meanwhile, on the other side, the EFF, led by Julius Malema, who we heard from second there, they're not part of this pact. The EFF favours far-left, more radical policies, a self-proclaimed Marxist nationalist agenda, including policies such as land expropriation without compensation and the nationalisation of mines and banks. And their party leader, Malema, was actually once upon a time the president of the ANC Youth League, was later expelled, formed his own party, and he has really emerged as a fiery populist figure and potentially a kingmaker in this election. And he was interestingly suspended very recently from parliament after he stormed the stage to demand President Ramaphosa's resignation. But despite this, of the two parties, the DA and the EFF, if the ANC does need to form a coalition, it is more likely to seek out the help of the EFF.
Well, let's talk about one ghost of elections past whom you alluded to previously. This is President Jacob Zuma. Here is former President Zuma.
Sizobuqeda ubugebengu uma sesiphethe izwe lethu. Kungakabi nabantu bokufika la babungekho ubugebengu kulamazwe ethu. Babungekho nokuncane.
You're going to have to help us out there a bit.
Yes, so I'll do a bit of explaining here. So where do we begin? Jacob Zuma, he has been barred from standing in the elections. The Electoral Commission banned him because of his criminal conviction in 2021 for contempt of court. The South African Constitution doesn't allow anyone who's been sentenced to more than 12 months imprisonment to hold public office. Zuma was sentenced to 15 years after he refused to testify before a commission inquiry, which was looking into a spew of corruption allegations that marked his term in office. Zuma was eventually kicked out of the ANC after he refused to vote for the party. He launched a rival party, the Umkhonto we Sizwe party, which essentially means translated Spear of the Nation. And the party is particularly targeting Zulu South Africans, which is the country's largest ethnic group, mostly concentrated in KwaZulu-Natal province. In this particular clip that we just heard, we hear Zuma speaking in his native tongue, Zulu, and he says, quote, "Before foreign nationals came to South Africa, there was no crime," unquote. And I think that really illustrates the role, unfortunately, of anti-immigrant sentiment in this election, and xenophobia and anger towards illegal immigration has been a persistent issue in South Africa for many years. We have a high number of foreign nationals, especially coming in from Zimbabwe, Mozambique, the DRC and Malawi, and they have often been scapegoated for unemployment, which some politicians, including apparently Jacob Zuma, are capitalizing on.
Well, finally, we should look at the role that will be played in this election by one very important demographic who will, of course, play a role in many subsequent elections as well. That is young South Africans who are disproportionately unemployed.
No, that's correct. And there have been quite a few reports in recent weeks, both local press and international press, who've been trying to speak to various disgruntled young voters. And I think we have a clip of one.
Young people have felt for the longest time that they were not part of the conversation because, you know, small things like the old people that are in governance, the gatekeeping that happens due to a particular organization that refuses, you know, to accept young voices, to accept young people to be part of policy, to be part of governance, to be part of many governmental structures. But for me, I don't think it's enough for young people to simply stand back and not vote. But I do agree that young people have a right to say we have not been included, we have not been part of the conversation. And they have a right to be concerned, they have a right to be disillusioned and also to be discouraged.
So what will young people be hoping to get out of this election other, obviously, than jobs?
Well, I think jobs would be nice. jobs is the main thing, and it's strange because I think young people could be a major deciding voice in the election. I was talking earlier about the ANC's powerful brand as the party of Nelson Mandela, but young people don't necessarily have the same ties to the ANC as their parents did. And in fact, anyone born after 1994, that we're known locally as the Born Free generation, we've never lived through apartheid. And so many young people, they want change, especially, as you say, when it comes to youth unemployment, which is quite shocking. I think I read a stat, 61% of South Africans aged between 15 and 24 are unemployed. And so young people do have much to be angry about. But on the whole, and this seems to be a problem in other countries too, they are not registering to vote. Less than half of potential voters under the age of 29 have bothered to register, which I think unfortunately does tell us how flat and how unexcited many young voters feel about what's on offer. And one can only hope that this changes, and soon.
Emma Searle, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. You are back with The Monocle Daily, and I am joined now by this evening's panel, which is Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Monocle Radio. Actually, we should change it to that. I like that. Monocle Radio's senior correspondent, and by Tom Webb, deputy head of Radio.
You should have gone with clowns, as you suggest. Yeah.
Tom, you have recently been, as will become agonizingly clear shortly, to California. Aside from the thing we're going to talk about, because the show is obviously meticulously structured and we don't want to give away where we're going. Aside from that thing, how was it?
Oh, wonderful. I'm very jet-lagged. It was very difficult packing for carry-on only because I went from -6 degrees to 30 degrees.
Are you one of those psychopaths who goes carry-on only?
I'm terrified of my bags being lost. When you fly with British Airways, you do have to do carry-on only. There's a tip for you. But I did Sequoia, which is 15,000 feet above sea level, which was 2 meters of snow all the way down to Santa Cruz, beautiful 30-degree sun. And then San Francisco, where I was warned, has faced some hard times on the streets. And I can prove, in fact, it's a little bit ropey at the moment. And I hope the mayor cleans up his act.
See, I haven't been to San Francisco for God help me, 30. No, it can't be that long. Now, I have been since, but I was there about 30 years ago and it was pretty ropey then. Has it become even ropier?
Without the hippies and gays on the street, it's become a little bit dodgy. It's Castro now is the only section where you can have a good time like it was 30 years ago.
Fernando, have you recently been to California, or is the established theme of the light introductory banter already running aground?
No, it's fine. But I was talking to Tom because I'm very curious about San Francisco. We do have a lot of listeners there. I mean, from what I hear, I think it's been quite challenging there. So I've only been to Southern California, to LA, which I know also have very similar problems when it comes to homelessness. But I have to say, I've been twice to LA. There's something quite, it felt very different and exotic to me. I mean, I'm not sure if I would live there, but there's something very different from what I experienced either in London or in São Paulo. It's so vast and it feels empty. There's something poetic about it, you know. It makes me cry, it makes me feel emotional in a way as well. Not sure if that's good or bad.
See, I always thought of Los Angeles and Sydney, at the risk of alienating our remaining listeners in both of them, that they Los Angeles and San Francisco just both struck me in different ways as kind of like Sydney, but not as good. Anyway, we will begin with what is hopefully a gathering realization that technology has not improved and likely will not improve on sentient humans checking out your groceries. Amazon has binned its so-called Just Walk Out technology, which permitted shoppers to basically behave like shoplifters but still have their card charged, which rather removes the fun from it. The factors driving the decision appear to have included embarrassment at the discovery that this apparent AI magic was in fact underpaid Indians watching everything remotely via video link, and the fact that all right-thinking citizens just hated it. Fernando, where are you on this? Would you rather have your groceries checked out by a surly, resentful human being or by an impersonal automated checkout?
Of course, the human being. And this news, they don't surprise me at all, because from the beginning, I was not a big fan of Amazon Fresh. Mm-hmm. It looks ugly. I don't like the design. It looks cheap. It's not my type of thing. It's actually very sad. So I'm not surprised at all. And I think perhaps we share this in common, Andrew. I know we had some conversations about this. Of course it's better to have a cashier. I mean, cool, they might be grumpy, but just smile to them.
They are always grumpy.
You can do some chit-chat. You can try a little bit, you know, here.
What's your opening chit-chat to a grumpy grocery cashier?
Well, it's not quite a supermarket, but I'm friends with the lady at Boots here, just 5 minutes from the office, because I go there very often. So she knows what about, you're not getting your Red Bull today or something like that. So there is some chit-chat. So I believe in that a little bit.
Fernando is a big spender, by the way. When they see him, they get very excited.
Well, I would think. Tom, as regular listeners of the free Monocle email bulletin, the weekend edition, will be aware, and if you are not one of those people, dear listener, you should be. I have views on automated checkouts. I will stand in a queue of almost any length for a human cashier rather than interact with an automatic checkout. I hate them. Nevertheless, do you worry, or at least do you share my fear, that this is only a temporary delay to the inevitable depersonalized modernist dystopia, or are you actually all for the seamless supermarket experience?
The seamless being having human beings, right?
No, having no human beings. Just being able to walk in, take all the stuff you want and walk out.
That's what most people are doing in London anyway.
Well, indeed so.
Nothing is being done about the shoplifting. I am a shoplifter pursuer.
Oh, I wish we could have. Can we re-edit the podcast so it just stops before pursuer? I'm asking the production booth. Just like I am a shoplifter, and then we'll play a sting.
I rung our services, 999, after I saw someone load a load of booze and walk out the shop. And the operator told me to pursue the shoplifter, which is quite a dangerous thing to do.
Really?
Yes.
What, you would deputized by a 999 operator?
I was. And then I pursued
him. That sounds just risibly irresponsible at so many levels.
I pursued him into another shop. So, and then I had to tell the shopkeeper, oh, you need to watch out for this guy, he's going to steal some booze. But then the shoplifter heard me and came over, and to which I had to ask the shoplifter if he had any milk. To which he said, yes, obviously we have loads and loads of milk. So then I had to hide in the milk section and wait for the police to come and arrest him. But it was a very difficult procedure. It's very, very easy to shoplift now because you cannot pursue if you run a shop here in London.
So they get members of the public to do it instead?
If you're like me and just can't stand someone walking away with a free item.
Absolutely astonishing.
But to your question, no, I do like the personalised service, and I do. I'm a very, very thrifty shopper, and I like when the shop owner tells me what a bargain that I've discovered. That is a real highlight of my day.
Well, sticking with the theme of the encroaching AI dystopia and the doubtless futile efforts of humankind to restrain it, we will now consider the works of an activist movement attempting to rescue San Francisco. And now you see what all the foreshadowing was in aid of from the self-driving car. Their weapon of choice is a traffic cone, which, when placed upon the bonnet of an autonomous vehicle, causes it to freeze pending human intervention. The outfit in question, Safe Street Rebel, contends that cities should instead prioritise public transport and pedestrians. Tom, you were in California, as we have established. Did you go in a driverless vehicle? I'm hoping that the answer is yes, because otherwise this segment is going to be a total bust.
Yes.
Hooray!
I was with a group of friends who were part of the very small select group of people who are approved to book said car. It's a Waymo. It's a Jaguar. There's no driver whatsoever. Mm. You book it like an Uber. It pulls out of the darkness. It's got your initials on the taxi sign on the top. You climb inside and you hit a go button and off it goes. And it was so wonderful because having tipping people for 2 weeks on top of tax, no tip for the driver. It's very cheap. It's very comfortable. No small talk. It plays K-pop. And
it said that like it was a good thing.
And it's incredibly safe because it has a little radar, and everything that pops up, you know, I've mentioned the people of the streets in San Francisco, they do pop up in the middle of the road. It swerves very slowly around them, and there are no accidents.
Did you not, or was your ecstasy at being in this self-driving vehicle not somewhat tempered by the thought of the absolutely appalling things that must occur inside these vehicles on a fairly routine basis?
It is true, having spoken to my friend from the Castro district, you can get up to all sorts in there. However, they will know because there's such a small select group of app users.
Fernando, are you excited for the dawn of the autonomous vehicle, or do you fear it?
I fear it, of course. And you know what? It's funny that Tom was mentioning things that you can do in the car. I actually think driving is quite sexy. The act of driving. Mm. I don't drive very often. Very recently, I went to a village called Tatsfield in the UK. Beautiful to drive, listening to music and change the station. I think there's still something fun. Of course, I'm not saying that I'm just pro cars here. So there's something quite not sexy about driverless cars. So I understand, and I'm not sure how safe it is. I'm sure there's been a lot of studies, and I'm sure you will get better and better. But honestly, and again, I'm sure there's something we'll be talking here. What about the loss of jobs as well? Mm-hmm. I mean, our, you know, very reliable Uber drivers or cab drivers, I don't think it's something society needs
bus
that
drivers
much.
And bus drivers and truck drivers as well. You can see what the future is. I wanted to close this out by asking you each in turn, you first, Tom, where is your red line? What is the smallest vehicle that you would not get in unless there was a human being at the controls? I mean, we have probably all been on some sort of vehicle, even if it is just the Docklands Light Railway or an airport shuttle train, which does not have a human driver. We are all habituated to that. We will doubtless get habituated in due time to driverless cars, perhaps even driverless buses. Would you get on a driverless airliner?
I had a prepared answer for this. Mm. Forget the airliner, a Bangkok tuk-tuk. I would not get in an autonomous one of those, because if you cut someone up, which you will in Bangkok, you are going to be the subject of the aggression. And there is a lot of aggression towards tuk-tuk drivers.
Mm. Fernando?
Well, I wouldn't be on an airliner, of course not. Neither in a tuk-tuk, to be honest. As I said, I'm not interested. If it's driverless, I don't go. Maybe a DRL, I mean, if you really must, but the others, no.
You can sit up the front of the DLR and pretend you're driving, and that never gets old.
I'll do that, maybe.
Can I just say, for the interest of balance, there was a driverless car company in San Francisco called Cruise, which is no longer available because it did drag a woman 20 feet behind it after running her over.
That seems like the sort of thing that shouldn't happen. We will move along to fruit juice. Let it never be said that we shy away from the big subjects on this, The Monocle Daily. The internet, it says here, was apparently recently agog with the revelation that despite the apparent panoply of choice on your supermarket fruit juice shelf, most are actually, to a greater or lesser extent, apple juice. Examples include one passion fruit mango and guava smoothie, which is actually 62% apple, and a fruit and lychee drink fully 70% apple. Manufacturers claim that apple is used because it is versatile and its sweetness takes the edge off sharper tastes. Skeptics suspect it is that Big Apple is making the most of the fact that apples are relatively cheap. Fernando, do you feel like you have been cheated?
Yes.
You are wearing an orange T-shirt. Is it in fact 80% apple?
No, thank God not. But I have to say, the apple juicification of the world is tragic. And that's something that I noticed.
A couple of things I want to pick up on.
Yeah,
there.
No.
One is, are we calling it the apple juicification of the word?
Doesn't really
trip off the tongue. And tragic?
It is tragic.
Tragic.
I moved to this country over 15 years ago.
Was it to get away from the apples?
No, not really. Because I think in Brazil, maybe because I'm from a tropical country, when you want a passion fruit juice in Brazil, it's just passion fruit, ice and water, basically. But here they say suddenly they add apples. And I'm like, hold on a second, no apples for me. I'm not a big fan of apple juice. So yeah, I think the industry has been cheating us for too long. So I'm glad actually that articles like this, and it's becoming viral, so people are paying attention, because I understand it's cheap, sweet, whatever, but honestly, I don't want apples in my pineapple juice, for example.
Sounds a bit racist, Fernando. Tom, are you going to start now minutely reading a list of ingredients on the back of your smoothie?
I am part of this new Yuka app. I don't know if you've seen it. It's French. I scan everything.
Your French apps.
I know, but I...
Mr. La-di-da gonna web over here with his French apps.
I've been out of the juice market for 6 years. I haven't had a single glass of orange juice, apple juice, anything. So I really don't mind. The whole thing could be toxic. It wouldn't bother me at all. Terrible for your teeth. Terrible for your waist. Don't drink juice anyway, regardless of apples in it or not.
I wanted to end on a willfully controversial point. I wanted you to... we may have Tom's answer already, but Fernando, what is, do you think, the best apple? See, I would say I am lucky enough to have in my garden in London two actual apple trees, but I couldn't tell you the last time I actually had successfully an apple off one. One, because of, this is incredibly interesting, the way the sun hits my street, most of the actual apples tend to land in my neighbour's garden, and the ones that don't, the squirrels eat. But they look nice while they're there.
You'd be happy to hear, although I don't like apple juice, I do like to eat as a fruit, as a solid fruit. And my favourite...
This is outstanding content, Fernando.
I know. My favorite apple is the Jess apples.
The Jess
because
apple.
They're hard texture. I like apples with hard texture. Don't come with mushy apples to me. I like the Jess ones. And I've heard the piñatas are good, but I never tried the piñatas. So if someone tells me where I can buy a piñata apple, I would be appreciated.
The night is young, Fernando. Tom, do you have a favorite apple?
A refrigerated pink lady.
And a favourite apple?
Very good. What I will say is the modern apples that we have nowadays, they have very, very little nutritional value compared to apples that Shakespeare was munching on 400 years ago. We've added so many sweeteners.
You should be getting a bit mouldy by now.
That's not my favourite apple.
We should start a revolution against this apple juicification, by the way.
How is that revolution going to... Like, what's that revolution going to consist of, Fernando?
I don't know. Let's protest against those industries that are lying to us.
Okay, well, you start.
I will.
You go off and man the barricades. Fernando, Tom and I will be right behind you. But for the moment, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Webb, thank you. And finally, on today's show, for months right across North America, anticipation has built for a rare event set to take place on Monday, 8th of April, a total eclipse of the sun. This is a rarity not only because the full eclipse this time round will last so long, for more than 4 minutes, but because such large swaths of the populations of Mexico, the US and Canada will be within what's called the path of totality. More than 30 million people in the US alone will have a view of this total eclipse. But among the best vantage points is the Canadian city of Niagara Falls, where more than 1 million visitors are expected to gather on Monday to view the solar spectacle. Monocle's correspondent in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, spoke to the mayor of Niagara Falls on the Canadian side of the famous waterfall, Jim Diodati, about his city's preparations for the big day.
The clock is ticking until the eclipse, less than a week away now.
This solar eclipse is coming, folks. It's happening Monday, April the 8th.
Well, millions of Americans will look up into the sky next week to witness the rare total solar eclipse. Well, scientists will also be focused on the sky using the configuration of the moon for a unique opportunity to study our sun.
Up to 1 million people could watch the eclipse from Niagara Falls alone. The region is along the eclipse path of totality, making it one of the best places to watch this rare event. The total eclipse is expected to last no more than 4 minutes over different communities across Niagara and will start around 3:15.
My name is Jim Diodati, the mayor of Niagara Falls, Canada. We are ready, Thomas. Niagara Falls is used to hosting 14 million people every year, not all at one time. And it's predicted that we'll host upwards of 1 million people that day for the total solar eclipse. So we're working very closely with all levels of government, all police forces, ambulance, fire. It's all hands on deck approach to make sure that we're proactively ready for whatever comes that day. And of course, the final determinant will be the weather, because we live within about a day's drive of almost half the population of North America. We call it the rubber tire market, the people that can drive here. And a lot of people can make a game time decision based on the weather. So that's the unknown factor. But as of now, it's looking to be a clear day, which means it'll be very memorable.
So I just wonder how a city like yours prepares for 1 million people to descend on it for one day.
The last total solar eclipse here in Niagara Falls was 99 years ago, and the next one will be in 120 years. So it's safe to say this will be the last time we see it here. The interest has been enormous. I mean, I've got media from every corner of the globe reaching out more than any other event. And we've had some other hugely successful events, like when the very famous tightrope walker, Nick Walenda, walked across the falls in 2012. We had about 150,000 people here for that event. And the people, the experts that are doing U.S. documentaries and following along with this, along with NASA, the Canadian Space Agency, and the Guinness Book of World Records will be here. They have told us to expect 8 to 9 times that crowd. And what I think, Thomas, the magic is, this isn't man-made. This is Mother Nature. And the idea of one of the great natural wonders of the world, Niagara Falls, the iconic Niagara Falls, hosting one of the great celestial events of the universe, same place, same time, there's something magical and mystical about it. And I think that's why the immense global interest with this event.
And a few days ago, a state of emergency was declared in the Niagara region. That on its own seems like a fairly dramatic declaration in its own right. Maybe you could explain what it means in this context of Monday's eclipse. And do you think it might have the effect of deterring people from making the journey to Niagara Falls?
Well, the actual declaration was done by the regional government, upper tier government for the region of Niagara, which includes Niagara Falls. The city itself did not make the declaration. We thought maybe it was a little premature. And usually you save them for actual emergencies like blizzards and tornadoes and train derailments, not for something that may be a challenge. So it's done now. The cat's out of the bag. But it's had, an opposite effect. What it's done is it's drawn much more global interest and much more media uptake. And it's had the exact opposite effect. So the idea was that potentially the regional government could access provincial and federal money for extra police and extra ambulance and extra firefighters and all the other frontline staff that'll be working that day. It'll be an all hands on deck approach. I mean, the rail, they've added a lot of extra cars for the commuter service to come here from Toronto. We're right on the border. We have 4 international crossings to the United States right here in Niagara. We know those are going to be extremely busy. And as it's looking now, the weather's supposed to be good. So I guess they felt it was better to proactively measure twice, cut once. But it did give me an extra opportunity to remind our visitors to come here with your gas tank filled or your car charged, to bring medication if you need it, cereal butters, water, make sure you've got comfortable shoes for walking, maybe a chair to sit down to observe the solar eclipse or a blanket, and leave lots of time. Another safety precaution, we've brought in extra cellular towers because the concern is not enough bandwidth when everybody wants to reach out to someone they love. And the other part of safety, which is also entertainment we've tied together, is we're bringing in entertainment during the physical eclipse. We're going to have the Niagara Symphony Orchestra playing some very appropriate music, ominous music. And when the eclipse is concluded, we've got some great Canadian bands. One of the opening bands is the Glorious Sons, and they'll be performing. And it's not to bring in more people. It's to get people to leave gradually, because we've learned from hosting Canada's biggest New Year's Eve shows, right after the final fireworks over the falls, people head to the cars. And the problem is, when everyone does it at the same time, you have gridlock, you have traffic jams. So we're encouraging people to generally, slowly and gradually leave, not all at one time. And that's why we have the entertainment. That's why we brought in extra cellular towers. We're trying to, again, be proactive and figure out and anticipate what may go wrong and then prepare for that.
And it would be remiss of me, as a Welsh person, not to mention that I have heard a rumour that Bonnie Tyler herself had been invited to Niagara Falls for the big day on Monday, but she was otherwise engaged, it seems.
Yeah, you're right. And her famous 80s song, Total Eclipse of the Heart, we thought, wouldn't that be so appropriate? But yeah, she was already committed to somewhere else. I can tell you a lot of the restaurants, too, are having thematic meals and drinks like sips for the eclipse. And things like this. So everybody's having fun with it. We've even got Guinness Book of World Records here. We're going to attempt a world record. The most people wearing a sun costume at one time. And we're going to be in one of the large boats in the Niagara River just below the falls. And we'll be doing that to break a world record. It was a record set in China, as I understand it. We've got our History Museum staff working on this one. So we fabricated all of these costumes. And I'm going to be wearing one of them as well. It's going to be a day off. All the schools have shut down that day. Everybody's going to be participating and communing with nature, with each other, and having a good time doing things like this. And it's funny how society's changed, Thomas. In the 70s, I remember a partial solar eclipse. I was in school, and the teacher said, get away from the windows. They closed the curtains, and it was a danger. Well, today, we look at it totally different, and we say, we're going to go outside, and we're going to put our glasses on, and we're going to look up at the sun. And as soon as the moon covers it, we're going to take the glasses off and we're going to experience firsthand a solar eclipse. It's amazing how the world has changed. And here in Niagara Falls, where typically in a sunny afternoon, you get that amazing rainbow cresting right over the falls. Well, when the full solar eclipse takes place, that rainbow will go pink. So a lot of people are going to be taking in a lot of interesting once-in-a-lifetime opportunities right here in Niagara Falls. Now I'm only falling apart. Nothing I can do, a total eclipse of the heart.
Thomas Lewis closing that conversation with Niagara Falls Mayor Jim Diodati with some frankly gratuitous Bonnie Tyler. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our guests today, MSL, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Tom Webb and Thomas Lewis. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and researched by George Ruskin. Our sound engineer was Lily Austin with editing assistance from Flynn Simons. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time on Monday. Thanks for listening.